This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, I get to bring you a conversation with Sam Levine. He's a national reporter covering voting rights in the United States at The Guardian. He writes about issues related to voter ID, partisan gerrymandering, and voting rights in general. I hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. Sam, thank you so much for joining me. We were talking a little bit before we started recording, and I'm hoping that you can start by telling us, you're somebody who focuses on voting rights. What do you expect for the next 4 years, and how are you personally preparing? Let's start with that.
Well, one thing we know is that the Trump administration has made no secret of what their approach to voting rights is going to be. Trump has refused to concede that he lost the 2020 election and has made election denialism, questioning election results, questioning election administration a cornerstone of his political identity. And so I think one thing I'm thinking a lot about now is just, once he's in control of the federal government, how can he use the apparatus of government to serve those purposes? And, you know, as president, one clear avenue for him to do that is through the Department of Justice and through specifically the voting section in the Department of Justice.
So I know that this is bread and butter for you, but for a lot of people who think about voting rights, they might know broadly what the Department of Justice does, but could you lay out for us what is the Department of Justice responsible for doing, and how does a change in administration really affect a change in what that particular division does?
The Department of Justice, you know, put simply, is the agency that's responsible for enforcing federal laws. There are various sections in the department. There's the Civil Rights Division, which enforces civil rights law. There's the National Security Division, Criminal Division, Environmental and Natural Resources Division, all of which have their different focuses. But when it comes to voting, you know, in the United States, there's actually very little power that the president himself has over voting. We have a system where voting is largely administered by the states, and within each state, it's administered at the local level. There's no like central agency in the United States that runs election. But the clearest power that the president has is over the Department of Justice, which is responsible for, you know, launching federal criminal investigations. It's also responsible for enforcing civil rights laws, including voting rights laws. And this is one way in which the president can wield enormous power over elections. And, you know, typically every administration has different priorities. And, you know, even in an administration that is committed to protecting voting rights, the Department of Justice is not known as a particularly active litigator in this field. They're very careful and deliberate about the kinds of voting rights cases that they bring. They typically want to bring big cases where they know they can make a difference. They're typically on big substantive issues like a statewide redistricting case or a challenge to a statewide voter ID law. And they'll bring a few of those big, meaty cases in every administration. And until the Trump administration, you know, there was some shift in priority from administration to administration, but that was sort of the standard. But in the first Trump administration, we really saw what I think is a significant break from that. Immediately after Trump was inaugurated, we saw the Department of Justice represent that they were going to switch sides in a few ongoing voting cases. They had been supporting a challenge to Texas voter ID for years. And right after Trump was inaugurated the first time, they said, we're actually reversing our position in this case. They had been supporting a challenge to the way that Ohio removes people from the voter rolls. They were on the side of plaintiffs in that case who said Ohio was being too aggressive. After Trump was inaugurated, they actually reversed their position. And my understanding from talking to former department lawyers, litigators, is that is very unusual. You know, typically the standard practice in cases like this is, you know, you might take a different position in new cases. You might take, you know, choose to file cases differently, but you don't really switch sides in the middle of a case when the administration changes. And, you know, the idea there is that the Justice Department speaks on behalf of the United States. It's not really representing the views of the president. It's not representing the views of a political party. It's saying, this is our interpretation of federal law. And that should be consistent as much as possible across administrations. So that was very unusual.
Well, and that's really helpful for us in terms of situating who controls the levers of power and what we could expect to see. I'd like to jump out of the Department of Justice for a moment, because obviously they're bringing suits under existing laws. And there's a question that I think people will have for you as somebody who's a voting rights expert and has covered this area for a good deal of time. There's been so much discussion about new legislation. We did have a Democratic president, and we did have a lot of excitement among members of Congress. Why did we see no new piece of voting rights legislation come out of this Congress, particularly in the aftermath of the 2013 Shelby County decision, where the Supreme Court essentially trashed half of the Voting Rights Act? There could have been a legislative solution. It's been 11 years, lots of conversations. What's happening on the federal level with respect to legislation?
In the first half of President Biden's administration, remember that Democrats controlled the House, they controlled the Senate, and obviously they controlled the White House. And there was a big push to try and get federal voting rights legislation passed. This would have been the most sweeping voting rights legislation in decades. It would have reimposed a new formula to put states under federal supervision if they continually violated the voting rights of minority groups. It would have put other protections in place. And that effort failed because of the filibuster. It passed the House, but, you know, Democrats did not have enough support in the Senate to overcome the filibuster. And I think that really ignited the conversation about getting rid of the filibuster in the Senate. President Biden did not support that at first. And as it became clear that Democrats weren't going to be able to pass this legislation, he became more and more vocal about it until he got to the point where he actually called for the abolition of the filibuster in connection to this legislation. Democrats couldn't do that. There were two senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, both of whom are now retiring from Congress, but they did not support doing that. So the filibuster remains. The filibuster is the 60-vote threshold required to advance legislation in the Senate. So Democrats have been unable to pass federal voting rights legislation. Similarly, Republicans more recently have tried to advance legislation to require proof of citizenship when people register to vote. And they've been unable to do that because they didn't control the Senate. And now, you know, it remains, you know, a little bit unclear what will happen next. For now, the filibuster remains in the Senate. Republicans have said that they're committed to keeping that. But if they were to get rid of that, you know, I would expect that an effort to require proof of citizenship might be one piece of legislation that they would try and pass.
So we are looking at kind of competing desires, let's say, when it comes to federal legislation. I think there's actually some confusion about the current state of federal legislation. Very briefly, what are our current federal laws here when we're talking about the Voting Rights Act? And I know we throw around words like Section 2 and partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering. We know that partisan gerrymandering, those are not claims that you can bring in federal court anymore as a result of a Supreme Court decision. But what is protected currently? Is it basically just Section 2 and largely how Section 2 operates against racial gerrymandering? Is there more that we should be thinking about?
Well, the Voting Rights Act, which is sort of the crown jewel of the nation's voting rights laws, has been in effect since 1965. And like you mentioned earlier, Jessica, in 2013, the Supreme Court dealt the law a huge blow. The most powerful part of the law was a provision that said certain places in the country with a history of discrimination, and there was a formula that Congress had said was appropriate for evaluating that, were required to get voting changes pre-cleared by the federal government before they went into effect. And the Supreme Court, you know, said that the formula was no longer appropriate and has essentially gutted that part of the law. But what remains is Section 2, which prohibits, you know, voting practices that discriminate on the basis of race. And that remains the most powerful tool in the law that the Department of Justice, that voting rights litigators have available today to challenge laws. And we see Section 2 used a lot in redistricting cases to challenge redistricting plans, maps that are racially discriminatory, that dilute the power of, you know, a particular racial group. And we see it challenge voting restrictions, statewide voting restrictions. It was used to challenge laws in Georgia during the Biden administration. But Section 2 has come under threat in recent years. There have been a number of legal efforts to significantly tighten the scope of the law, make it harder to bring a challenge under Section 2, and make it harder to win a challenge under Section 2. And the thrust of that is two things. I think the first path that those challenges have taken is really making it really, really hard for a plaintiff or a challenger in a case to show that a voting practice is racially discriminatory. Republicans have tried to set a really high bar for what you need to show to prove in federal court that a redistricting plan or a statewide voting practice is discriminating against a particular group. And the second is a more existential threat, which is this idea that has popped up just in the last few years that actually private plaintiffs may not be able to bring cases under Section 2 entirely. There's sort of a novel theory that's moving through the courts that says, actually, the text of the law only authorizes the Justice Department to bring cases under Section 2. And it's a bit unclear if that's something that's going to stick in the courts. And there are various other pieces of litigation that voting rights litigators think could blunt that. But if that were eventually upheld, every voting rights lawyer I've talked to has said that would be the death knell for Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. You know, the Department of Justice is not equipped in the way that private plaintiffs are to monitor, you know, things on the ground. They move a lot more slowly than, you know, a civil rights group like the ACLU or the NAACP Legal Defense Fund moves. The Justice Department might not have an issue in local races like a school board race, a city council race, that might attract a lot more attention from a nonprofit. So that is another avenue that voting rights litigators are very, very concerned about.
Well, and that concern makes sense here. And in terms of the proposed legislation that we've been talking about, we talked a little bit about the Democratic proposed legislation, but on the Republican side, I did want to pick up on something because I get this question. I'm sure you've gotten this question, you know, short of 200,000 times, which is, well, how can I trust the system? And you mentioned the potential push on the federal level to have some requirement that there be proof of citizenship before people vote, because we know only citizens can vote in federal elections. I'd love to broaden this out a little bit and just ask you to remind us, What are the checks in the system, not really on the federal level, but more on, as we know, the county level, the state level, so that people can have faith in our voting systems?
Well, every voting system is different. You know, it's run differently in all 50 states and at the local level. But, you know, there is widespread consensus among election officials that, you know, there isn't widespread non-citizen voting. You know, maybe, you know, someone might slip through the cracks here and there by accident. But if you really think about what someone who is a non-citizen would have to do to go through the system and not only register, but vote, you know, they would have to make a pretty concerted effort and be willing to risk their immigration status to cast a ballot that would only be one vote in an election. And, you know, if you're someone who, you know, is at risk of, you know, being deported or, you know, is in the U.S. for other reasons, it just doesn't make any sense. But that said, states, you know, first on the voter registration form, you know, have a clear warning that, you know, you have to be a citizen of the United States in order to register to vote. And you have to sign the form under penalty of perjury that you are a citizen. And then once you register, you know, states typically check that against existing databases to make sure that you're a real person, that you are who you say you are. And if you weren't a citizen, that's typically, you know, when that would be flagged. So, you know, I've been covering voting rights for almost a decade now, and almost every single case I've seen where a non-citizen, you know, gets registered or accidentally votes, it's because they were led to believe that they were eligible. Someone offered them the opportunity to vote, or they didn't understand the requirements. I've seen no example that comes to mind of someone who deliberately tried to get through the system.
Well, and to emphasize this, what do studies indicate in terms of how rare voter fraud is in general, not just non-citizen voting, but more generally, any intentional fraud in the system?
It's extremely rare. I think it's the statistics have shown it's even more rare than getting struck by lightning. I mean, you know, people who, you know, suggest it's a major issue, you know, like to sort of group all of the cases together over, you know, a period of several years. But you think, you know, if you had 100 cases over 10 years, and even that might be high, you think of, you know, in each election, there's millions of votes cast. We're talking about, you know, far less than 1%, and in some cases, less than 0.5% of, you know, the total votes cast. But it is exceptionally, exceptionally rare.
And one would hope isn't really a partisan issue in the sense that the statistics really do speak for themselves. You have, as you mentioned, been covering voting rights for a long period of time. And I'm just curious, what are the biggest things that you wish people understood better? I'd like to talk next a little bit about ending where we began, talking about looking at the next 4 years. But it strikes me that you must, as you're writing and reporting, have pockets where you think, I wish people understood this, or this is important, but there just isn't enough time to cover it. Are there places where you feel like there's just common misconceptions or misunderstandings?
I think especially when it comes to election administration, you know, people, if they are lucky, you know, think about voting, you know, once a year, maybe once every 2 years or once every 4 years, and they hopefully have a pretty seamless experience casting their vote, and then they don't think about it anymore. But there is an enormous apparatus that's going on behind the scenes to verify that people are eligible, that is ensuring that when someone requests a ballot, that their request gets verified and sent to the right address, and that, you know, they have the right address, and that the person who returns the ballot is the person who requested the ballot. You know, that all is sort of the unsexy work of elections that's going on behind the scenes that people don't really understand how it works because ideally they're not seeing it. And I wish people understood how committed election officials are and how much work goes into, you know, ensuring that, you know, the number of ballots they have matches the number of people who voted, ensuring that every vote is accounted for, and, you know, that it's not something that just miraculously happens on election day. It's something that officials spend years preparing for. And I would say that's a thing that I think I wish people understood more, is that this is not just sort of a very simple system. It's something that has lots of bits and parts behind the scenes that is enormously complicated.
Which would make it very difficult to engage in any sort of broad conspiracy to throw an election, because you would need so many different people in so many different places to come to an agreement. I mean, my understanding is because elections and election administration is so dispersed, that in many ways that dispersal is a safety net for us, because again, it would take so many people to try and undermine our faith in the system.
That's exactly right. You know, if you think about what a massive conspiracy would take, you would need people to, you know, first all organize in some significant number to undertake a conspiracy to commit voter fraud. And then you would also need, you know, several people not to notice anything was amiss. And, you know, every election, you see things like election officials notice that, you know, there might be a suspicious number of signatures coming in from one person for a ballot initiative or something like that. And, you know, every time something like that happens, people like to emphasize, like, you know, look, someone was trying to cheat. And this is evidence that the system is vulnerable to fraud. But I think you can also take the opposite message away from that, that, look, the system caught it. You know, that some people are paying attention, and there are systems in place to verify these things, and it didn't work. So, yes, the fact that things are so dispersed makes it extremely difficult to cheat.
Well, I think that brings us almost full circle to, I began by asking you how you're personally preparing. Now I'm hoping that we can pivot a little bit, still talking about the next 4 years, to how should we be preparing? So what should we be on the lookout for? I think you explained very clearly what the Department of Justice does and how things could change under the Department of Justice. And of course, the proposed legislation. Are there particular pockets where you think this is where we should be looking ahead to see movement in X area? And maybe it's related to legislation on the federal level or on the state level, or maybe it's back to litigation.
I think there are a couple things. I think on the Voting Rights Act, looking at the positions that the Trump administration takes to understand if they're going to continue to try and weaken the law, or if they're just going to pull back from enforcing the law. And at the state level, on voting restrictions more broadly, you know, over the last 4 years, there's been a huge effort to impose new restrictions on voting, particularly on voting by mail. This is something that came largely out of the pandemic. But one lesson for Republicans from the 2024 election is that they got a lot of support from, you know, what's called low propensity voters, people who don't typically turn out in elections. And one thing that I'm curious to see is if, you know, recognizing that more people turning out could actually benefit Republicans changes their approach to voting legislation. You know, maybe they will think twice about a law that limits the number of days for early voting, or that makes it a little bit harder to register, because they might begin to see that that might not be as politically advantageous. So I think that's another thing that I'll be paying very close attention to. And I think, you know, another thing is just, you know, there's going to be a huge emphasis in the Trump administration on immigration. You know, we're expecting mass deportations, the continued demonization of immigrants. And I'm curious if that's going to fall over into voting, you know, if we're going to see investigations and allegations of mistakes of, you know, non-citizens casting a ballot and things like that. And there'll be an effort to sort of spin up accusations of a broader conspiracy when there really isn't one.
Well, that's really helpful in starting to organize our thinking going forward. And Sam, you are truly an expert in this area. You have tirelessly reported on issues that are really important to me personally and professionally, but also important to so many of us, because we know that this is the basic right and that every other right flows from our ability to vote. So I want to thank you so much, not just for your time, but for doing what you're doing.
Thanks so much, Jessica, and happy to come on anytime.